From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
The selective recovery and a shrinking middle class. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Wall Street is setting records never imagined before, and the housing market is on the rise. Does that mean the Great Recession is over? Not according to the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, which says average American households have recovered just 45% of the wealth they lost. Others say the reality of two Americas has crushed faith in stabilizing institutions, farms, factories, public schools, and the political system. We'll hear what it feels like to be on the losing end and look for signs of a better future. On Reporter's Notebook later on, another chapter in the ongoing scandal of doping in Major League Baseball. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Marvin Alney, back with To the Point. Despite headlines suggesting that the Great Recession is over, average American households have regained less than half what they lost, and some may never fully recover. We'll hear about that later today. On Reporter's Notebook, Alex Rodriguez and Ryan Brown may be among the 20 players suspended for drug use by Major League Baseball. First, this news update. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad is claiming a major victory today, as rebel forces have pulled out of Qusayr, a town on the border with Lebanon. For 3 weeks, the attack has been led by the forces of Hezbollah. That's according to Martin Chuloff, who's Middle East correspondent for The Guardian. He joins us from Beirut, and good to have you back on our program.
Good to be with you.
Tell us how important the loss of this is for the rebels, the gain for the president.
It was a strategically significant town for the rebels. They were able to use this town to disrupt a regime supply line from Damascus to Homs, from Homs being the Syria's third city. Qusayr was only 30 kilometers south of that. The rebels were able to regularly intercept attempts to reinforce the regime forces in Homs by attacking that road. So for them, it was a particularly important site. For the regime, they clearly had an interest in getting the rebels away from this road, and they did. But more broadly, though, the reason that Qusayr was important to them is that it was a Sunni town amidst the Shia villages to the south, both in Lebanon and on the Syrian border. And to the northeast is the Alawite heartland. The Alawites are linked to the Shias theologically. And more importantly, they are Mr. Assad's sect, and from where he draws his power base. So there had been a plan that, I guess it was a fallback plan, nothing more than that, to allow for a contiguous link of Shias to Alawites going straight to the northeast and then up around to the Mediterranean coastal cities of Latakia and Tartus, which are very much Alawite strongholds. This Sunni town of Qusayr being in the way of that was a problem. It's not a problem anymore.
What about the importance of Hezbollah as the major fighting force apparently responsible for this?
Very, very important. The large public and high-profile intervention made by Hezbollah into Qusayr has resonated across the region. It has deeply heightened sectarian tensions, not only in Lebanon and Syria, but elsewhere. Hezbollah is exclusively Shia. The opposition fighting in Syria is almost exclusively Sunni. The opposition, certainly in Qusayr, was Sunni. So what this has done is pitched one of the sects of Islam against the other, and that really has drawn strong resentment, bitterness, and belligerence from elsewhere in the Arab world, and it has heightened the risk that this sectarian contagion that we are seeing slowly creeping from the conflict in Syria will now spread far and wide.
You have visited the town itself fairly recently. What kind of shape is it in?
It's in terrible shape at the moment. Certainly over the last 3 weeks, it had been bombarded from above and from afar, shells and jets. It had no running water, no electricity. It had no medicines. It had run out of food and water. And that was one of the reasons that the rebels who had vowed to fight to the end found themselves with very little option but to flee to the north last night. So There were 30,000 residents there before this war broke out. That was 18 months or so ago in Qusair. They had gradually trickled away, but I would estimate that there were around about 15,000 still there as of 3 weeks ago, and there is no word yet on what has become of those people. There have been no ability at all to get any access to that town today. The Red Cross have been trying. I think the coming days will reveal the true cost to the civilian population.
What are the prospects of this bringing Sunni countries from the region into the fighting more directly than they have been?
I think what it will do in the first instance is it will incentivize the Qataris and the Saudis to step up their gun running. I've had conversations with senior officials in both states in recent weeks, and they did say that the Hezbollah intervention has meant that they will do whatever they can to make sure that that Sunni rebels are better armed than they have been. So they will continue to do that. They will make more efforts to make sure that bigger and better weapons do get to them. I don't think it's going to extend to the possibility of nation-state armies, say, from either of those two countries or elsewhere, arriving in Syria to take on Hezbollah, but it certainly will be very much a regional proxy war fought along this ancient sectarian fault line.
And will it encourage President Assad to continue to fight and make it less likely that he'll step down, which, of course, he said he will never do?
Well, there's no doubt that this has been a morale boost both for him and for his beleaguered military, who over the last year or so had been unable to gain any ground across the country. In fact, they'd been incrementally losing ground in many of the key battle zones. So the large and public intervention of Hezbollah has been a boost for him. I would anticipate that the Hezbollah forces, and we're talking at least 1,000 men in Qusair, maybe up to 2,000 if you take into account people elsewhere in the country, they will, from this point onwards, be playing a pivotal role as Assad looks to wind back his losses. I would think that next step, Aleppo and the Alawite heartland that I speak of.
Martin Chulov in Beirut for The Guardian. And many thanks, as always, for being on our program.
You're welcome.
In a moment, the selective recovery and a shrinking middle class. On To The Point.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. Record-selling stock prices and a housing market that's on the rise have led to reports that America has recovered from the Great Recession. But the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis says the balance sheets of average American households show a very different reality. Ray Boshara is director of the bank's Center for Household Financial Stability. Good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Warren.
Why is it so important to focus on balance sheets?
Well, the traditional measures of household well-being have generally been income and wages. We found that if you look at household balance sheets, your savings, the quality of your financial services, your debts, your assets, your net worth, reveal new insights into how families move up the economic ladder, but it also gives us new insights into how the economy grows.
So what have you concluded as a result of your study?
Well, the first thing we did was look at what the American dream of homeownership, the pursuit of the American dream of homeownership has done to the balance sheets of America. We set four records in the last decade. We had the highest homeownership rate ever recorded, 69%. We had the highest concentration in wealth in homeownership since at least 1952, about a third. The highest personal debt-to-income ratio since 1952, and the lowest personal savings rate since 1934. Basically, you put these four forces together, these balance sheet failures. We had the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression, and we harmed the stability and upward mobility of millions of families and future generations. And debt was really what was driving this downturn. So the reports have been that the wealth that we lost in the recession has been recovered. But in fact, we found that, the Fed reported earlier this year, back in March, that 91% of the wealth that we lost in the recession over a five-year period had been recovered. And we found that, in fact, if you factor in inflation and population growth, that 91% drops down to 45%.
So in other words, then, we have two Americas, one regaining its wealth, one not.
That's basically correct. You could actually divide it up into three different groups. We found, you know, what predicts success? What predicts a healthy balance sheet? And we've determined that being older, being white, and having more education means that you are likely to have a healthier balance sheet and to have recovered most of your wealth. So we found that middle-aged and older, white or Asian groups, and college-educated Americans have recovered anywhere between 85 and 95% of their wealth. The next group, which is still struggling, white or Asian, college-educated but under 40, have recovered about 63% of their wealth. And also African Americans, you know, who are, even those who are better educated and middle-aged, have only recovered about 60%. But the third group, those who are not white, who are young, and don't have higher education, they've only recovered about 21% of their wealth. And in fact, they're weaker now than they were 20 years ago.
What does this say about the future of the country, particularly given the growth in population of people who are of color?
Well, it's very worrisome. If, as a matter of fact, if you look at what's going on with people of color, the wealth gap right now between whites and non-whites is about 20 to 1, and the gap has grown significantly over the last 25 years. You know, it's very concerning to us here at the Fed and throughout the nation that, you know, they not only have generally lower levels of income, but significantly lower levels of wealth. And when you don't have wealth, you're not likely to move up in America.
So what does this say about the number of people who have lost jobs and the difficulty that they've had in getting them back?
Well, this only compounds their problems. You know, it's bad enough not having a job or social safety nets, but when you don't have wealth, you are so vulnerable, you are more likely to fall back and not be able to recover from those losses. One of the odd things about the recession is that the very families who were already vulnerable to a downturn, people with low income, low wages, low skills, poor financial services, were the ones who took on the most risk in terms of their balance sheet. So not surprisingly, those very families have had the hardest time recovering their wealth and also have the most difficult prospects for doing so.
Ray Beauchara, once again at the St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank, director of the Center for Household Financial Stability. Joe Sangataldo is a job counselor from Camden, New Jersey. He is, or was, unemployed for more than 2 years. Joe Santaglio, thank you very much for joining our program.
Thank you. It's nice to talk to you.
First, you were a job counselor for the federal government. Tell us about that job and how it compares to the job you have finally gotten after 2 years.
What I did was job training under a federal job training act. It's something I've done on and off. I've been doing this type of work for over 20 years. And there became a decree that there was a shortage of money and six of us were laid off. But it was ironic. It was right in the middle of the recession. And it was at the very end of 2010 when the people were lining up at my desk. I had hundreds of people in files that were either on assistance or their unemployment had run out. And I became unemployed. What really astounded me was that there was no jobs in assisting people in getting jobs at that time and haven't been. This is the first opportunity I've had to go to work helping people find new work. And there's very little available, and I was just very lucky to get this grant, which is really just 6 months.
What did you do in between?
Nothing. I even tried to find jobs near the Atlantic City beach, near where I was living, cleaning bathrooms, and I couldn't find a job. The unemployment rate in South Jersey, and I'm talking the areas of Cumberland and Atlantic County, I think the unemployment rate might be right around 19%, and still is. This is not like just a, you know, expanded number. This is the actual hardcore number. So jobs are very difficult to get. I had unemployment, And I did run it out. I went back to school. Because I know job training, I got an associate's degree on top of a bachelor's in accounting. That helped a little. And then my unemployment was cut in July over the summer.
So when you were first working with the federal program, did you have benefits and did you have a pretty good salary?
It was one of those very nice and one-of-a-kind civil service jobs where there was some pension, which is rare, and full health coverage, sick days, all that sort of thing. You know, the pay wasn't real great, but it was a respectable job, and I was very happy to have it and thought, you know, here I am helping people get work. I should be okay for a while. And, you know, no, I guess even job counselors aren't important in a recession. So we had to go on unemployment.
So you're back counseling people. Do you have a pension? Do you have health care? Do you have sick days?
No, I don't. I have no health insurance. I haven't had any health insurance since October of 2010. I might get some offer once my probation's done. I'm very happy about the Affordable Care Act coming in because in New Jersey, you can earn just under $16,000 a year and be eligible for free health care, which is going to be great the first of the year.
What about your housing?
I'm able to pay for a small one-bedroom apartment near some great transit. I moved. I sold my family home and moved a little closer to the city. So, you know, this job really helped bring in some money because the only thing I was able to do otherwise was get a Christmas job at the mall for about 6 weeks and then couldn't get rehired even at minimum wage. I was like pretty scared.
Again, Joe Sangataldo is a job counselor still, once again, after 2 years of unemployment, except for that brief time during Christmas in Camden, New Jersey. George Packer is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. His new book is called The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. George Packer, good to have you back on our program.
It's always good to be with you, Warren.
Tell us, if you will, your book is long, involves many, many interviews with a lot of people, as well as a lot of very interesting use of headlines and public accounts of what's going on in the economy. Does Joe Sangataldo sound familiar to you?
Yes. I met him in Youngstown, Ohio. I met him in Tampa, Florida. I met him in Rockingham County, North Carolina. It's a all too common story, although every individual is different. And my book is a collection of stories of individuals, but they're woven together into a 35-year narrative history of America, told from the point of view mostly of ordinary people in places like the ones I just mentioned. And you really don't have to go far in America these days to find suffering and dislocation and misery. And it's a strange country we live in right now because they can often be simultaneous and right next door to comfort. I mean, I live an hour and a half from Camden in Brooklyn, New York, which is booming. I'm talking to you right now from Silicon Valley, which is more than booming. It's a kind of incredible, magical success story out here, and yet right next to, you know, Palo Alto or right next to Brooklyn or even in Brooklyn, there's chronic unemployment, there's homelessness, there's the hollowing out of the middle class that your first guest talked about statistically. And that has been a 30 or 35-year story in America that has been with us so long that we hardly even think of it as a story any longer. But I'm glad you're talking about it today.
How is it that we've missed it?
I think partly the media are drawn to the centers of power and wealth because those stories are more attractive, more glamorous, so that the coastal cities, New York, Washington, L.A., and San Francisco, seem to dominate the attention of media. How many bureaus still exist in St. Louis and Chicago Atlanta and Nashville? So there's a kind of a magnetic draw toward prosperity and toward elites, toward celebrities. I think our our life is so stratified today that during the Great Recession, which I really think should be called a depression, the way many readers and consumers of news were given stories about it was through the stories of elites. It was a story of hedge fund managers and bankers and regulators and people who won big and lost big. It was not so much, it was harder to find stories about places that had been in a state of depression for years and simply went further down, or even places that had had the sort of intoxicating bubble of housing burst and went from a high to a low. And those are the kinds of American stories that I tried to find and to weave into The Unwinding.
And you have some very interesting analysis about institutions that have failed in various ways. I want to get back to that. But first, Joe Sangataldo has to get back to work. He's still on the job, or finally on the job once again. Joe, do you feel that you and people that have had similar experiences to yours have been ignored?
Oh, I definitely do. When I was working before I got laid off, it seemed like all the people unemployed were just forgotten. It was almost like you're on your own. I didn't see a whole lot of support from officials for the number of people that were seeking work. The problem in New Jersey really hasn't improved very much. It has in some states, but New Jersey is one of the worst states for unemployment still. And wages are absolutely down. I really think I'm making the same thing I made in like 1994. And I've been very careful to be accurate about that. I mean, I really don't see the return to the American dream coming anywhere soon in this area at all.
So have you felt invisible?
Oh, well, definitely. It feels good to be back working a little. I certainly like helping other people find jobs. It's something I know well. It was very difficult for me to find myself a job. That's how I knew we had a problem. And I don't have to work in this field. I mean, I couldn't find a job doing just about anything. There's a number of people applying for all the positions. Going online anymore doesn't work. Nobody reads your resume anymore. You really have to do what I did, and that's volunteer for a while with an old employer who was broke, and they managed to get this position through an internal blast, and I was able to find out about it. I probably wouldn't have learned about it had I been at a work site.
You said
people who are unemployed are really out in the cold right now.
You said you got some training, and yet you're back doing exactly what you had done before. Do you feel like you're still in the middle class?
good question. Probably not. If so, the very lower middle class, and don't see where I'm supposed to be able to climb up. And I'm not blaming anybody. I just think that we've really downgraded the American worker experience completely.
Well, that's all the time we have for you, Joe Sangataldo. I know you need to get back to work. You're very kind to have been with us. Thank you for telling us your story, a job counselor in Camden, New Jersey. We're going to take a very brief break. We'll come back, continue this conversation on Reporter's Notebook later. Alex Rodriguez and Ryan Brown may be among 20 players suspended by Major League Baseball. We'll hear about that back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Check out our new YouTube video channel, The Q. KCRW DJs curate themed video playlists and feature artist clips straight from YouTube. Add some visual to your audio. Explore now at kcrw.com/theq.
Norman Olney back with To the Point. If there are two numbers to remember from this conversation, they are these. The Federal Reserve says 91% of the wealth lost due to the Great Recession, called a Great Depression by at least one of our guests, has been recovered. But if you look at the balance sheets of average Americans, they have recaptured only 45% of the wealth they lost. That's a big difference. We just heard from Joe Sangataldo of Camden, New Jersey, who says he doesn't even feel like he's in the middle class anymore. George Packer is staff writer for The New Yorker, once again, a new book, The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. Tell us how it is that you feel that American institutions have declined as a result of the economic situation.
Right. My book is a panoramic but also intimate look at this past generation in American life. It begins in the late 70s because I see that as a moment when some of the institutions that had been set up or strengthened under Roosevelt and in the post-war to support the aspirations of middle-class people like Joe Santacalgo began to erode. And we could name them one at a time, from government programs and banking and corporations and news media and schools. All of them began to weaken, or at least to lose their value for middle-class people, and some of them shifted their emphasis toward the upper levels. And I think that marked the beginning of the end of a social contract, a deal, an unwritten contract between Americans that said if you do your part and work and educate your kids, they will have a better life than you, and you will have a secure retirement. And that Americans know that deal is off, even if for some people there's still the promise of it. That for so many Americans, the security of that post-war contract no longer exists. There's a lot more freedom, there's a lot more choice, and we're sort of dazzled by gadgetry and by consumer options, by information that floods us, but we have given up a degree of solidarity and security that wove the society together. And so my book follows the lives of about half a dozen Americans as they navigate these very rough waters over the past generation.
It also includes, as you indicated, necessarily because of all the focus on the celebrities and people who are at the upper end of the scale, and the hedge fund managers and the bankers, but also people whose names are very familiar. And you sort of rank them in terms of those that you have respect for and those you don't.
Well, a reviewer ranked them, and I'm not sure I completely agreed with his okay. 1 to 10, but I mean, I chose them partly for the interest of their individual stories and partly for the sector of society they represented. From politics, there's Newt Gingrich, because I think more than any single political figure of this past generation, he shaped and contributed to the polarization of Washington that we all know and live with today. From business, there's Sam Walton, a self-made empire builder who turned America partly through his doing from a manufacturing power to a retail and consumer economy in which there was both a downward pressure on prices but also on wages. He contributed to the hollowing out of the middle class in towns all across the heartland. From entertainment, there's Jay-Z, whose career represents an amazing rags-to-riches story from the projects of Brooklyn to a corporate near billionaire, but it also represents a sort of win at all costs vision of success where success becomes its own justification, and how you get there and what corners you cut don't matter. And that is true of so many of the stories of celebrities today, and they all now exist in a kind of super class in which they know each other. They're a world unto themselves and have left the majority of their countrymen far behind. And to understand both how the bottom, see their own fates, and how the elites have, I think, begun to abandon the sort of custodial relation they had toward institutions, instead taking on a more selfish attitude, you have to understand the lives of celebrities. So I included 10 of them in The Unwinding.
George Packer, again, a staff writer for The New Yorker. Once again, his book, The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. Mark Zandi is chief economist at Moody's Analytics. Good to have you back on our program, and thanks for
joining
us.
Thank you, Warren. Appreciate it.
Do you agree with what we're hearing from not only George Packer, but also from Ray Boshara of the St. Louis Federal Reserve, our first guest, about the 45%, and from Joe Santacalgo, who provided such a grassroots experience that apparently is very common.
Right. Well, I agree with your characterization that there are, I think it was your characterization, that there are two Americas, that you can take the median household income in the country, which is about $50,000 a year, and those folks that are making around the median or less than that are obviously struggling very significantly with high unemployment, underemployment, if they have a job, very little wage growth, and, of course, no wealth. Probably don't own their home, or if they own their home, they have no equity in it. They have some student loan debt, credit card debt. They're in tough financial shape. The folks that are in the upper part of the income distribution, you make over the median, and those that obviously the higher income levels are doing very, very well. They generally have a job. In fact, college graduates, if you have a college degree, your unemployment rate is closer to 4%, which is high by historical standards, but obviously pretty low in the context of the current environment, and are very wealthy, doing quite well. The stock market, until the last few days, at a record high. House prices are rising in many parts of the country. If they have any debt at all, it's probably a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage loan, and they've been able to refinance and lock in these very low interest rates. They may have an auto loan, but only because it's free money. You know, you can get an auto loan for 2-3% if you have a good credit score. So I really do think there is something to the characterization of the two Americas. And this has become more striking over time, clearly a bigger problem than it was 20, 25 years ago.
And the people at the top are far less numerous than the people at the bottom. We've heard about the 1%, and that's a figure that a lot of people, I think, really understand. Do you agree with George Packer that this is sort of the end of the social contract?
I don't think I'd go that far. You know, I think what's happened here is broader in terms of the economic forces at work, and there are a number, but the one that I would focus on is globalization. Our economy has become much more global. And in fact, that's helped to increase the size of our economy. But unfortunately, it leads to this skewing of the distribution of income and wealth, because if you're talented, if you are one of those rock stars or highly educated, you can essentially sell what you do to the rest of the world. And you couldn't do that 50 years ago. You can do that now, and you can make a lot of money. Of course, if you don't have skills in education, you're toast, because you're competing against, you know, folks from China, Brazil, Russia, India, where their wages are a lot lower. So I think it's that broad economic force at work that has created this problem. And, you know, I don't think the solution is to end or even slow down globalization. I think it is a net positive for our economy. But we have to work really hard to lift the well-being of people who are being left behind, educate, train, raise the skill level and educational attainment of these folks that are being left behind.
So you think that's the main reason to deal with it. What are we going to do about the people whose skills at the moment don't allow them to get employment or recoup the wealth that they have lost? Are they just sort of a lost generation?
No, I do think we need to focus on it. I think one of your other guests was pointing out, and it may have been the poor fellow who's been lost his job for a couple of years and just got back in, who was a counselor. We as a nation have done a very poor job, and I think this is isn't recent, this is from the beginning of time. We've done a very poor job of thinking about how to retrain, re-educate, really help people gain the skills and talents that they need. Now, it might not have been as important 50 years ago because we were in a different world, but today in this globalized world, we need to do this, and so we need to think about it. And we don't. We don't really think about this at all. There's no systematic way of helping people without those skills in education get those skills in education. And by the way, I mean, one of our answers to this problem has been to facilitate more borrowing through student loans, and that probably just exacerbated the problem, because unfortunately, colleges and universities and schools are able to raise their tuition and capture that student loan, and the poor kids who are getting these loans aren't finding education any more affordable. So our answer to the problem really has not been a help. It's actually been somewhat, I think, counterproductive.
Haven't you said, though, that you think the economy will be back on its feet pretty much by the middle of this decade? And if so, does that contradict what you're saying? Or are you saying it'll be back for those people who are at the top, but not necessarily for everybody else?
Well, the economy is going to come back. And here's just a statistic to kind of square that circle for you. The folks that are in the top 5% of the income distribution, so these are the very high-income households, consume one-third of all the things that we consume. The people who are in the top 20%, you know, that's the top fifth, they consume almost two-thirds. So the economy, you know, the broad economy, the averages, can do quite well, and they will do quite well going forward. But this economy can't flourish unless everyone's participating. So I'm arguing the economy is going to come back. And ultimately, as the economy comes back, it is going to lift more boats. That unemployment rate in Canada is going to come down. There's going to be more jobs, so things are going to get better. But, you know, I don't think our economy is going to be in full swing and we're all going to be feeling pretty good about it unless we really refocus on this problem of the distribution of income and wealth and really what to do about it. And that gets to education, training, raising the skill level of the population.
Mark Zandi again, a chief economist at Moody's Analytics. Ray Boshara, back to you, director of the Center for Household Financial Stability at the St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank, one of the authors of the report that came up with that 45% figure, the amount of wealth, the percentage of wealth that most people have been able to recover. Are you as optimistic, if that's the right term, as Mark Zandi?
I think we eventually will recover, but I think, according to our analysis, the debt overhang is going to be with us for several more years. And until we fix household balance sheets, we're not going to have a full recovery.
George Packer, do you think that we have the will, given all that you have said about the various institutions and about the culture in general, particularly as it's portrayed in the media, to do what's necessary to restore what we had in the past?
Well, the first thing to say is this has been such a long process. It's been 30 years of this. So to say we're going to return to where we were before the Great Recession means we're going to return to a point in which the middle class was already sinking in a lot of parts of the country. So to return to the status quo ante isn't exactly a recovery. It's a return to a very fragile, bubble-driven economy where there just weren't engines of growth that created broad prosperity. But I'd say, you know, if globalization, of course, is a huge factor here, but globalization is part of what is driving the undoing of the social contract. And when you ask if we have the will, it isn't just these blind economic forces. It's policies. It's politics. It's decisions made in Washington and in Wall Street and elsewhere. I mean, if you look at Germany, which also is subject to the same trends of automation, globalization, technological progress, they've somehow managed to preserve a manufacturing base and a secure middle class. And that's entirely because they've made policy choices that the U.S. has not made. We want, you know, a more extreme version of free enterprise than Germany does. And the result is the conversation that we're having. And I thought that the financial crisis, the election of Obama, and a real sort of a sense of an epical shift would begin to change those policies. But Washington is so broken today that it doesn't seem like it's going to happen anytime soon.
Mark Zandi at Moody's Analytics. Is Washington so broken that it's going to make it much more difficult to accomplish what you outlined?
Well, it's certainly dysfunctional. I don't know that it's completely broken. But, you know, I would concur. You know, there are policy steps that we should take, and it's hard for us to do it in the context of the political environment that we find ourselves. And I am sympathetic to the argument that Germany has found a way to put forward policies that have helped promote a more broadly distributed income, distribution of income and wealth. So, you know, I do think politics do play a role. I don't mean to discount that at all. I just don't think that's the driving force. But you know, I don't.
Well,
could it
be the driving force for a more just recovery, if that's the right term?
Yeah, I think that's fair. You know, I think that we haven't been able to find a way to come together politically to address some of these very pressing issues. Now, you know, we've done some things. I mean, I think healthcare reform is an effort to address some of these imbalances in the distribution of income and wealth. You know, we can debate the pluses and minuses of that, and there's a lot of pluses and minuses, but that's an effort at trying to address it. You know, it's not completely fair to say that policymakers haven't come up with help who've lost their jobs. I mean, unemployment insurance has been expanded. You know, for some people in some states with very high unemployment, they could get unemployment insurance for 100 weeks, which is, you know, very long. The normal period is 26 weeks.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but when you talk about health care reform, there's a real effort afoot to repeal it, and if not to repeal it, to make it very, very difficult to institute it. So I guess that goes back to the question I asked George Packer. Do we have the will to do what's necessary to do?
It'd be tough. I mean, it's tough to get anything done in Washington. Again, it's dysfunctional, but I don't think we stand completely still and done nothing. I mean, I think we've taken a crack at it, but you know, I'm critical too. I think you know, our politics are dysfunctional, and it really is not helpful to trying to address these longer-term issues with regard to the distribution of income and wealth. One other thing I would say, though, is that as we continue to debate how to address our long-term fiscal problems, the size of the deficit and our debt load, and obviously it's in the best interest of everyone from rich to poor to get our deficits down and get on a more stable fiscal footing. But as we do that, we have to think about what it means to the distribution of income and wealth. What are those tax policy changes? What are those spending policy changes mean for people who are being left behind in this economy?
George Packer, a final word to you. 30 seconds left. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think inequality, I think Mark Zandi and I seem to agree about a lot of things, but inequality is this pervasive force in our lives today. It's everywhere. It controls so much about culture and even about the way people see their lives, so that even when the top 10 or 20% are beginning to recover the wealth they lost, they still have this anxiety because they look up and they see preposterous wealth building at the top. They look down, they see this really frightening sinking middle class that they could fall into if they have one or two setbacks. And that creates a constant sense of insecurity, and I think it continues to fray the contract that used to bind Americans together through institutions that supported middle-class people.
Okay, that's all the time we have. George Packer, again, The Unwinding and Inner History of the New America. Thanks to you. Thanks to Mark Zandi at Moody's Analytics. Thanks to Ray Boshara at the St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank, and our guest, Joe Sangataldo from Camden, New Jersey. Good to have all of you on our program. Thanks very much for being with us. ESPN is reporting today that Major League Baseball may be about to seek the suspension of 20 players in what could be the largest scandal in American sports history involving performance-enhancing drugs. Major stars are said to be in jeopardy. We'll be back with that in a moment on To the Point.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Once again, there are reports that as many as 20 baseball players, Major League Baseball players, may be suspended. The names include Alex Rodriguez and Ryan Braun, as a result of yet another involvement with performance-enhancing drugs. Jeff Passan is a baseball columnist for Yahoo Sports. It's good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Bring us up to date on what the latest is. And is this just more of the same? This was supposed to be a post-steroid era.
It was supposed to be, but unfortunately, as baseball found out when this Biogenesis scandal was revealed, we're far from post-steroids. It's not as prevalent as it was back in the 1990s and early 2000s, but whether it's baseball, the NFL, the NBA, the NHL, Olympic sports, boxing, you can talk about every athletic endeavor out there, and performance-enhancing drugs remain a huge topic of not just conversation, but use by players. And the reasons and rationale make sense. There's a lot of money out there, and there's a lot of glory out there to be had. And if you can improve your performance in any way, whether it is legal or illegal, athletes have shown themselves willing to do so. And in this case with baseball, you've got upwards of two dozen guys, huge names like Ryan Braun and Alex Rodriguez, who have been ensnared in this scandal down in South Florida with Anthony Bosch, the proprietor of the Biogenesis Clinic, who's agreed to speak with Major League Baseball now and tell them everything he knows.
Tell us more about Biogenesis and Tony Bosch.
Biogenesis was one of those wellness clinics. You see these anti-aging places pop up all around. It's very prevalent, especially in Florida. And what they purport to do is keep you from aging. What in reality a lot of them do is distribute illicit drugs that the government has deemed illegal. And whether that's human growth hormone or different steroids of any manner and variety, very common ones like Decadurobilin or designer steroids like the ones you saw in the Balco case out in San Francisco about a decade ago, they're there to help athletes. And Major League Baseball for the last 8 years now has had a drug testing program in place, and it is one of the best, if not the best, in American professional sports. And yet, of all of the names on the Biogenesis log rolls that Anthony Bosch kept, and that have been put out there publicly by now, first by the Miami New Times and at Yahoo Sports. We broke Ryan Braun's name and ESPN. We know the majority of the name. Only four guys have been under suspicion or suspended and been caught using these drugs. And it just goes to show you, as good as the testing is, there are almost always going to be ways to beat it.
Let me read you a little bit of, and our listeners, a little bit of what ESPN, which broke this story, is reporting, that the commissioner of baseball might seek a 100-game suspension for Rodriguez, for Braun, both of whom we've mentioned, with the penalty for two offenses. And the two offenses would be, one, a connection to the Bosch lab, and two, lying about it to a Major League Baseball officials. Does that sound right to you? Is that the way Major League Baseball operates?
Yeah, it does. There was a guy named Cesar Carrillo, who was Ryan Braun's road roommate and teammate down at the University of Miami when they were playing college together. And Cesar Carrillo got a 100-game suspension, which they were able to mete out without the Major League Baseball Players Association appealing it, because minor league players are held to a different standard than the major leaguers, who are under the collective bargaining agreement. And so we saw for the first time somebody get 100 games for what could be deemed a singular offense. But what baseball hates almost as much as using performance-enhancing drugs are the players who try and get out of it by not telling the truth. And you do wonder if Tony Bosch's willingness to speak now is going to prompt some players to change their stories and maybe try and avoid the sorts of penalties that Cesar Carrillo got and that Ryan Braun and Alex Rodriguez seem in line for.
Well, what about the penalties? These guys have played a lot of baseball games, and suspension is one thing. Why don't they get them where it really hurts and fine them?
Well, when you get suspended, you do lose your paycheck, so there is that. But unfortunately for baseball, this is a collectively bargained joint drug agreement, and the terms of which have been hammered out over many hundreds of hours sequestered in rooms. And look, this is just part of a much larger CBA, but unfortunately, in the eyes of baseball officials, where they would love to void the contract, say, of guys who do test positive, they're simply unable to do so because of what has been bargained.
You mentioned Balco in the Bay Area. Barry Bonds was one of the major victims there. Also, Marion Jones, the runner, and others as well. Why is this one worse than Balco?
I think this one for baseball in particular is worse than Balco, because at least back in 2002 and 2003, when Balco was really breaking wide open, steroids were not exactly outlawed in baseball. I think there was a moral question about them. There was an ethical question, certainly, but you could walk into a baseball clubhouse with a vial of steroids, inject yourself, and you technically would not be breaking any of baseball's laws. Since 2006, when the joint drug agreement was introduced, and when testing, both mandatory and random, became part of baseball players' lives, there's been this mantra that there's nothing worse in baseball than using performance-enhancing drugs. Bud Selig, the commissioner, has railed against it. The Players Association has agreed with him on that. Hundreds of players think that it's just a felony against the game. And yet, despite all of those disincentives, including harsher suspensions than there have been in the past, and then are in the case in other leagues like the NFL and the NBA and the NHL. Despite all of that, you had almost an entire major league's worth of teams going to a rogue guy who was not even a doctor at a strip mall in South Florida to allegedly get these drugs. When you factor in all of those things, I think it makes it even more egregious.
We don't have a lot of time left, but are the drugs really enhancing performance all that much? When all these athletes perform at such an extraordinarily high level, are they buying into the promises of Dr. Feelgood, as other consumers do, in the hopes of getting something that the drugs really can't produce?
Yeah, I mean, you wonder how much of it is psychosomatic and how much of it actually works. I think the fact is this. Steroids have been proven to, if not enhance performance, then certainly help heal quicker. There have been studies of human growth hormone over in Europe that have showed it promotes significantly quicker healing. And when you're talking about athletes that play the rigorous types of schedules with 162 games and constant travel, sometimes you just want to feel better as opposed to play better, because feeling better ultimately is going to let you play better.
Why not let them do it?
It's a good question. I mean, considering all of the legal medical treatments out there that have very similar effects to performance-enhancing drugs, ultimately it comes down to designation by the government. The government has said that certain drugs are not legal, and when the government says so, the leagues tend to fall in line and adopt those same rules.
All right, Jeff Passan, again, the baseball columnist for Yahoo Sports. Great to talk with you. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Much obliged. Appreciate you having me on.
All right. Today's program produced by Evan George with Alina Anwar and Anna Scott. Our technical director is Mike Newport. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.